The civilization thus inaugurated runs its course to the nadir of its material evolution, the point furthest out from God. Metaphorically speaking, it is at this point that it has to turn about and come back on the evolutionary R, and it is here that the star logos or Christ of the ray comes to it upon the physical plane. Before his coming, the ray is an outpouring of the divine life, governed by the laws evolved in previous evolutions, but the star logos says, "Ah, a new law give I unto you." The function of the star logos, incarnating as man, is twofold. Its exoteric aspect is to live the archetypal human life, the life that all men of that ray will live when they have achieved perfection, and thereby to impress that standard of life and action on the group mind. And so he is not only TT perfect God, being divinity made manifest, but he is also perfect man, or the archetypal ideal of humanity for that phase of evolution, and what he is during his brief earthly manifestation, all men must be when they are made perfect, even as our Father which is in heaven is perfect. The crests of the rays always manifest on the physical plane during the sub-cycles of the ray, which corresponds in number and color with the ray itself. Thus, it was on the fourth sub-cycle of the green ray, in the fourth sub-race of the fourth root race, that the Manu Narada founded the Temple of the Sun in the city of the Golden Gates in Lost Atlantis. The Manu Narada was a lord of mind, for the Atlanteans were evolving the conscious mind. It was in the same way that the archetypal ideas were brought to mankind by the Manu Melchizedek, who was a lord of flame and also of mind, and to this school it is that the most ancient initiations of our present race are traceable, and therefore it is that the highest of our initiates are referred to as high priests after the order of Melchizedek, that is to say, they trace back their spiritual lineage to a primordial initiation. Alcohol, whatever may be said of its abuse, was originally the Western equivalent of the soma juice, the means whereby the brain was enabled to respond to the vibrations of abstract mentation, which it is the function of this root race to develop, just as the Atlanteans developed the concrete mind and bequeathed it to us. Drunkenness is one of the characteristic evils of Europe. What alcohol was to this sub-race, the knowledge of using the endocrine glands will be to the next sub-race. This knowledge has long been the secret of the initiate, and forms the basis of the yoga breathing systems, but exoteric science is now discovering these truths on its own account, and therein are contained the seeds of destruction. It must not be thought, however, that because the Manu of a ray functions as a priest-king only at its inception, and the star logos of a ray as its Christ in the sub-cycle that corresponds in its number of the ray, humanity is ever left without guidance. Each sub-cycle of a ray, each sub-race of humanity, has its great one. These entities may be distinguished from the star logoi by the fact that of the Christs it is always recorded that they manifested through virgin birth and died a sacrificial death, and in this there is a deep occult significance. It may not unreasonably be asked, how can the foregoing statements be verified? No one who has developed rational consciousness can be justifiably asked to accept finally any statement on faith, and therefore, as obliged by the laws of his nature, he demands evidence. The evidence in these matters is based on the law of correspondences. As above, so below. What is true of the microcosm, man, is true of the macrocosm, and what is true of man is true of the amoeba, and what is true of the amoeba is true of the macrocosm. Unless the findings of a psychic fit into the cosmic system, they cannot be considered accurate. Therefore it is that the psychic who is not also an initiate is at a grave disadvantage, for he can never compare his measures with the Great Pyramid. There are no exceptions in the cosmic law. Neither do the metaphysics of the different occult schools vary when understood in their purity, and it will be found that the scheme set forth in the preceding pages, though derived from the Western tradition, in no way conflicts with the scheme which M. Blavatsky outlines in The Secret Doctrine, and which he received from the Eastern tradition. Chapter 11, The Sources of the Esoteric Christian Tradition. The different pantheons of the great cosmic faiths, Egyptian, Greek, or Christian, represent the symbol systems wherein the abstract truths taught by their founders, the sons of God, are enshrined. The Christian is a very abstract system, it has been far less anthropomorphized than most of the others. In Christianity, therefore, we see a very spiritual presentation of the one truth. And for its full apprehension, a very highly developed spiritual intuition is necessary. Consequently, where that intuition is lacking, Christianity makes less appeal, for it lacks the intellectual interpretation which is the food of the concrete mind, and herein lies a weakness of Christianity and its incompleteness. The great founders of the faiths give a spiritual teaching and a spiritual impetus only. It is the priesthoods who subsequently work out the theology and ceremonial. The men who made primitive Christianity were drawn from two sources, initiates of the mysteries and non-initiates. Of the former, St. Paul and St. John the Divine are examples, and the influence of their mystery training can be clearly seen in their work. St. Paul distinguishes between the things which he can say openly to all and the things at which he may only hint for the benefit of those who can take the hint. There naturally sprang up a keen rivalry between the two types of Christians, those who had accepted the teaching of our Lord without any previous mystery training depended entirely upon spiritual intuition and good works. Those who were already accustomed to the methods of the mysteries sought to express the Christian truths in the language of the esoteric philosophy of their day. The first chapter of the Gospel according to John is an excellent example of the process whereby men already highly trained in mystical knowledge correlated the new teaching with that which was already familiar to them. In this Gospel we see the influence of the Greek schools of initiation. But in the Apocalypse we see the influence of Kabbalistic thought. The Gnostic schools were the Christian mysteries, made by initiates of other mystery schools who had become converted to Christianity and sought to establish within the Christian dispensation the methods to which they were accustomed. In the struggle between the two types of Christians, the initiates and the non-initiates, the latter eventually gained the day. And forthwith the order for persecution and abolition went forth against the mysteries of Jesus. The orthodox element then gradually developed, as was inevitable, something of a mystery system of their own in the sacraments, which are ritual magic pure and simple, as is agreed even by such an authority as Evelyn Underhill. But with the development of the sacramental system did not, unfortunately, go the metaphysical interpretation thereof. Superstition has been defined as the use of a form whose significance has been forgotten. The sacraments, instead of being the symbol systems of the mysteries of Jesus, approach perilously near to vain observance in the hands of those who regard them with superstitious or rather than an understanding of their psychological and esoteric significance. Consequently, there is an unbridged gulf in our modern Christianity between the mysticism of its deep spiritual truths and the symbolic and magical ceremonial of its ritual. This gulf it is the task of the modern mystery schools to bridge. These, however, have in many cases re-illumined their fires at an Eastern altar, so that the bridge they build does not lead to the Christian contacts of the West. Those of their followers who seek initiation, instead of having revealed to them the deeper issues of their own faith, have to change their religion and follow other masters. How are we of the West, therefore, to bridge this gulf? We must do what the original Gnostics did, seek to express in the metaphysical language of the mysteries the teachings of our Lord, and thereby establish an esoteric Christian school of initiation of the West. The Gnostics drew their inspiration from two main sources, the mysteries of Greece and the mysticism of Israel, the Kabbalah, with which our Lord was obviously very familiar. These are the sources wherein we shall find the mental and magical interpretation of our religion which shall supply the missing keys. The elements which were discarded from Christianity must be replaced if it is to become a true wisdom religion, and unless it can answer to the needs of the intellect as well as of the heart. Those who need the food of the intellect rather than the heart will seek it elsewhere, and we cannot blame them. Equally, it follows that unless the relationship between occultism and religion is clearly recognized, the sacred science, deprived of its spiritual inspiration, will speedily degenerate onto the left-hand path. Occultism, rightly understood, is the servant of religion, and not an end in itself. Its task is to bring through to the astral plane and within reach of the apprehension of our finite consciousness those spiritual forces which, Without that concentrating formula it employs, diffuse and are lost in the sands of mortal mind. Occultism is the method par excellence of manipulating the human mind, and if it be used as the handmaiden of religion, it brings spiritual influences to bear in dark places that otherwise would be unapproachable. Let us grant, therefore, that in any school of Western mysticism the author and finisher of our faith must be Christ Jesus, the great initiator of the West, and that in his name we may safely do that which, unprotected and unsanctified, we dare not attempt. All the gettings of occultism must be dedicated to God's service, otherwise there is no justification for this intrusion on nature's mysteries and the forcing of the higher faculties to birth before their time. The highest degree of initiation is crucifixion for the salvation of mankind, the vicarious abreacting of racial karma. Let those who aspire to initiation bear ever in mind what reward it is that will crown their efforts with a crown of thorns. Unless we have so great a love for humanity, so great a sympathy for suffering, that we are not only willing but anxious to avail ourselves of the opportunity in some small measure to offer ourselves as a sacrifice for the sins of the people. There is no point in setting out upon the way of initiation, for its goal will be dust and ashes to the man who remains unregenerate. The aim of initiation is neither magical power nor marvelous experience, but simply the ability to offer an acceptable sacrifice that shall be effectual for the neutralization of cosmic karma. Go as we have already seen, there have been repeated attempts to develop an esoteric aspect to Christianity. Our Lord and some of his immediate followers were unquestionably versed in the Kabbalah, and Greek and Alexandrine influences had touched most of those who were the builders of the primitive church. These influences crystallized into the Gnostic aspect of Christianity. Later, however, there were other attempts, and the three most notable of these were, first, the school of initiation which had for its symbolism the Grail and the Round Table, and which drew its inspiration from druidical sources. This school disappeared in the general disorganization of society during the Dark Ages. Secondly, the Knights Templar who, while fighting the infidel in the Holy Land, came in touch with the last survivors of the secret tradition of Israel and from them received initiation. They brought back to Europe the secrets thus gained, giving them a Christian expression, until their suppression in AD 13 AD 7. Thirdly, that curious movement which announced itself by the publication of the Pharma Fraternitatis. This gave rise to alchemy. A separate book would be required for an adequate study of any of these sources of inspiration, but enough has been said to indicate to the reader where he may look for the headwaters of Western occultism and most profitably pursue his studies. Chapter 12. The Alphabet of the Mysteries. All esoteric systems use a symbolic method of notation in their teachings. Each of the symbols employed indicates a spiritual potency, and the ideas associated with them indicate its method of function. Their interrelation represents the interaction of these forces. If we have the key to one symbol system, we can readily equate it with all the others, for fundamentally they are the same. All the gods and goddesses in a pantheon, with one exception, represent nature forces and fundamental spiritual principles, for the one is but the obverse of the other. This system of symbology is capable of translation into terms of each plane of the manifested universe. Upon the physical plane they equate with what we will call, borrowing a term from the East, the mundane chakras, that is to say, the points upon the physical plane where the contact is made between the unseen and the seen. Different types of force have different points of contact. These are represented by the 12 signs of the zodiac, the 7 planets, and the 4 elements, and have their correspondence upon the different planes of existence with the different grades of the celestial hierarchy. The knowledge of these is always one of the carefully guarded secrets of the mysteries, and is never revealed outside their portal. These cosmic symbols are further represented by the letters of a sacred language, which, in the Western tradition, is Hebrew. Out of these letters are formed the sacred names and words of power, which are simply algebraical formulas resuming potencies. Thus is the universe represented to the initiate, and he is able to trace the correlation between its parts and see what invisible realities are throwing their shadows upon the world of Maya, illusion. Employing this principle, rituals are constructed which are designed to bring the soul of man into touch with the potencies represented, and divinatory systems are worked out which reveal the combinations and movements of these invisible forces. Do not let it be forgotten that divination, which is the discernment of the unseen, is a very different thing from fortune-telling, to which it bears the same relation as scientific medicine to catch penny nostrums sold at a country fair. In speaking of the pantheons of the gods, it was noted that each god stood for a spiritual principle or a natural force, with one exception, the sacrificed god, and he stands for the soul of the initiate, to whom he is also the great initiator. The pantheon can, then, be approached from two aspects, the external and the internal. It can be discerned in nature or in the soul of man. In its final aspect, the two become one. This is the aim of the work of the mysteries. There is no such thing as polytheism in the sense in which the term is usually understood. A father of the gods is always recognized who is the great first cause of the universe, and from whom all things emanate. We may, however, distinguish between the religions which look upon God as artificer as well as creator, and those who recognize delegation of function to lesser deities. But even in such a rigidly monotheistic faith as Judaism, it is recognized that the direct action of God in all matters is inconceivable, and so we get the concept of the divine emanations, or Sephiroth, and their manifestation in the four worlds of the Kabbalists by means of angelic hosts. In this concept there is no fundamental difference from that which underlies the Egyptian or Hindu pantheons, save that the angels of the manifestations are distinctly recognized as God's servants, not his fellows. The correspondences can be clearly traced between all three cosmogonies with the help of astrological symbolism. The student of the mysteries needs therefore to know his cosmic symbolism as set forth in these pantheons, and although he will take one of these systems as his key system and make it his own, he will be well advised to familiarize himself with others, because each has its own special development and application, and can throw much additional light on the system of his choice. For instance, the deepest natural magic is to be found in Egypt, and the highest metaphysics in India. But if he desires to make practical application of his studies, the initiate must investigate the soul of man as well as the nature of the universe, and the progress of the soul through its initiations he finds symbolized in the life or history of the Redeemer or Wayshower, who is for him the Grand Master and Great Initiator. He will find herein an epitome of the course of the soul from sensory consciousness to divine union. In the interaction between the different levels of consciousness and the corresponding planes of manifestation lies the essence of occultism. The psychic is one who functions negatively in this interaction. He reacts to the conditions he contacts, and thereby perceives them, but he exerts little or no influence upon them. The adept, on the other hand, while perceiving, does not react, and therefore functions positively in his relations to the subtle worlds, sending out his influence upon them instead of receiving their influence into himself. The magician might be distinguished from either of these two as one who knows how to influence subtler worlds, but, being unable to perceive them, is unable to operate directly thereon, and is obliged to depend upon intermediaries whom he evokes to serve his will. The true adept is not dependent upon the intervention of spirits, whether divine or diabolical, but himself works directly upon the plane of his choice, and as it is in the evocation of spirits and their subsequent banishment that the chief risks of occultism lie, it will be seen that the magus is in a very different position from the magician in his relations with the subtler planes. But in addition to his studies of subjects which are essentially occult, there are other sciences with which the student ought to be acquainted if he is to do justice to his task, for unless he has a working knowledge of them, he will be unable to appreciate the significance of a large portion of his occult researches. First and foremost of these is psychology, for without a thorough knowledge of the nature of consciousness he will be totally unfitted to cope with the intricate problems of consciousness which are constantly presenting themselves in the course of his studies, where, as a matter of fact, everything turns upon the nature of consciousness and its relation to the ego and the different levels of manifestation. the ordinary scholastic psychology, such as he would learn if he were going to be a school teacher, will have little interest for him. However, and after he has learnt its simpler lessons in relation to modes of apprehension and the classification of consciousness, he may safely leave the behaviorist school behind and proceed to the investigation of the analytical schools, especially the Jungian, for they will yield him far richer results. After some acquaintance with their methods and concepts, he should investigate the phenomena of hypnosis and suggestion and of hypernormal states in general. He will find that both the spiritualists and the Catholic mystics have much to tell him on these subjects that will repay his attention. Thus equipped with data which shall enable him to form judgments, he is in a far better position to investigate the unseen than if he ventured forth clad in nothing but the armor of faith. The consciousness of the seer and the powers of the magician are not things apart from natural laws whose operations can be seen and studied in other spheres as well as those of practical occultism, and it is through this comparative study that most light is thrown on their operation. A working knowledge of anthropology, archaeology, and folklore is also exceedingly valuable, for different systems, especially those existing among primitive peoples at the present day, throw much light on the ancient cultures and enable us the better to grasp their metaphysical significance. A general knowledge of physiology is also essential if the relationship between mind and body is to be understood, and the new work in physics is of especial interest to the student of occultism, explaining as it does the nature of the etheric substratum of the manifested universe. Finally, there should be some training at least in the methods and concepts of philosophy and the findings of comparative religion. Thus equipped, the initiate will have the necessary cultural background to enable him to approach his chosen subject in a scientific spirit and produce results worthy of serious consideration. Part 3, Practical. Chapter 13, The Training of the Mind. The grimoires of magic give instructions for the preparation of the magical instruments to be used by the magus in his work: the wand, the sword, the pen for drawing pentacles, and all the rest of them. But these grimoires themselves are the work of the uninitiated, with half-understood and misrepresented secrets stolen from the mysteries. This materialistic concept has persisted even among students of the subject who ought to know better. It is not in the elaborate processes used in the preparation of a material article that the virtue lies, but in the condition produced in the etheric counterpart of that article by the handling and thought concentration that it undergoes in the course of the operation. It is magnetized, firstly by the personal magnetism of the operator, secondly, an aura of thought forms is built up around it, and thirdly, by the right use of the imagination and the will, it is made the physical vehicle of an invisible, cosmic force, contacted by the operator and concentrated by him. H will be seen from the foregoing considerations that the essence of all practical operations is mental. It follows, therefore, that in the powers of the mind we find the key to the whole process. But although everybody has a mind, they have not by any manner of means all got the conscious use of these powers, though there are more people who have the subconscious and involuntary use of them than is generally credited. A large part of the training of an initiate must therefore consist in the development of these latent aspects of his mind. For the purposes of our study, we may consider the mind under three heads, as is usually done in psychology: feeling, will, and reason. But instead of considering them as the psychologists do, as separate units, we shall consider them as the Kabbalists do, as successive emanations resulting in equilibrium. We should thus see feeling and reason in polarity, and the kinetic will as resulting from their union. But this is not enough. According to Kabbalistic principle, a trinity thus formed must be resumed in a fourth principle upon another plane before it can become functional. If the plane under consideration is a lower plane, they will be resumed in a physical body which gives them expression upon the plane of matter through instinct, but if the plane under consideration is a higher plane, they will be resumed in that little understood faculty, the imagination. It is from this synthesis upon a higher plane, and from this alone, that occult power issues forth. We have to consider therefore the process by means of which the would-be adept is enabled first to dissect out these separate factors from the general coordination of his mind, purify and concentrate them, and resynthesize them upon a hierarch. This, of course, is the real process of alchemy, the great work. Dirt has been well defined as misplaced matter, purification consists in returning to its proper place whatever has become misplaced, thus mingling with, and thereby adulterating, that which is different from itself. Thus, if emotion intrudes into any intellectual process, it contaminates it and falsifies its results, for intellectual processes should be carried on in terms of reason alone in order that the ultimate issue may be truth. It follows that as a preliminary to all mental processes we must acquire such control of the emotions that they shall not function involuntarily. Such control is not obtained by the comparatively simple expedient of repression but by the far more difficult process of sublimation, so that the force generated by an external stimulus, instead of producing an immediate reaction of emotion, which might take place where it was not wanted, is directed to a more remote reaction, and discharges harmlessly upon another plane. Thus, an immediate reaction of resentment is transmuted into compassion and has its issue in charity. This is the first and hardest lesson that the seeker of the way has to learn, but once mastered, the powers thus acquired can be applied to the overcoming of other difficulties, for the momentum of the path is cumulative. The next task to which the neophyte has to apply himself is the training of his will. It may be thought that for some people that is a hopeless task, for they are naturally weak-willed. The will, however, is not a separate organ of the mind which may function adequately or inadequately. The will does not secrete force as the liver secretes bile. The will is simply the power to concentrate the available energies. It does not matter how strong-willed a man may be, he cannot drive body or mind beyond a certain point, nor does it matter how strong-muscled a man may be, he will not exert anything approaching his full power unless he concentrates his will. The strong will is really the single-pointed will, as we see all too clearly in the drunkard who is too weak-willed to stick at any work, but shows an amazing tenacity in obtaining alcohol. The secret of a strong will, therefore, is to concentrate it upon a single object. This can only be achieved by eliminating all competing objects which divide the attention of the will and so fritter away its energies. This is one reason that sacrifice is said to be the first step in the mysteries, for it is only by sacrificing ruthlessly all irrelevant interests that the single-pointed and potent will is obtained. It may be argued that a person thus concentrated would be unbalanced. This is a just argument, and the initiate overcomes it by employing the principle of rhythm. He says that although the bow must be tight strung to give flight to the arrow, the bow that is always strung loses its resilience, so he is careful to unstring his bow when it is not in use. Nevertheless, the object of a bow is to be bent, and therefore he never casts away the cord. In the earlier days of his training, an initiate goes through an exceedingly strict discipline, and every departure from the law of the path meets with immediate and severe punishment. There is but one way of safety for him, and that is a way as narrow as the blade of a sword and as straight as its edge. No human hand metes out this discipline to him. His teacher, the adept under whom he works as an apprentice, does all in his power by example and advice to save him from error, but he cannot constrain him, any more than he can avert the consequences of a broken cosmic law. Action and reaction are equal and opposite upon the path as elsewhere, and the neophyte has to receive the reaction of the forces his every thought sets in motion. By these forces he is uplifted or bruised as the case may be. After this section of the path has been passed, the way opens out, and the initiate may then safely take up again those things which he laid upon the altar of sacrifice which stands before the gate. The more richly endowed he is, the more he has to bring to his work. But after the discipline of the straight and narrow way, he will never again become attached to external things as he was before. He will always be their master, able to use them without becoming obsessed by them, so that, being free from there, bondage of things, he can use and enjoy them eto the enriching of consciousness. But the preliminary discipline, the quarter of freedom, is essential. The trained initiate comes to his work with the ability to clear the decks for action at the word of command and go through and over everything without looking to the right hand or to the left until he comes to his goal. After he has achieved, but not before, he takes an inventory of the breakage and binds up his wounds, and it is frequently found that the speed of his rush has carried him through comparatively scatheless. In actual life it will be found that there are very few people, or organizations of people, who / ill stand up to the bull rush of their